and welcome to Condensed History Gems with me, Greg Chapman.
And me, Jem Deducci.
And Jem, we've had a lot of requests recently from listeners, people I've been talking to, and they've all been saying, can we do some good modern history, something right up to date? So what topic have you got for us today?
The Stone Age.
Okay, well, I'm sure they'll be happy with that.
Well, I'm sorry. Well, when they said they wanted something modern, I thought they meant rock. So I figured I'd give them the most rocky part of history, the Stone Age. But, it doesn't get talked about that much, to be honest. And I just want to sort of say, for those of you who don't know, archaeologists and sort of historians, because there isn't really much history, pure history in that era, there are three eras of it. There's the Paleolithic, the Mesolithic, and the Neolithic. And what that all means is it's the Old Stone Age, the Middle Stone Age, and the New Stone Age. And the Paleolithic is the only bit of study in something like archaeology which doesn't necessarily include humans. The Paleolithic goes back about 2 million years and ends about, I mean, it does depend. The Stone Age ends in very weird times in different places, but let's say it ends about 50,000 years ago, give or take. So if we're looking at the story of humanity or of evolution, absolutely the biggest chunk, you grab all of known history around the world and drop it into the Paleolithic, you haven't even half filled it, okay? That is by far and away the longest period of the story of what eventually makes us Homo sapien. And then the Mesolithic is, I mean, again, slightly different, depends where. But particularly if we're talking about Britain and Western Europe, it's basically after the Ice Age, after the last Ice Age. So around about 10,000 BC-ish, particularly in Britain. And at that point, there's only Homo sapiens alive now. But we are hunter-gatherers. There's no sedimentary civilization yet. And really, that's the difference between the Mesolithic and the Neolithic. Neolithic, we start getting small towns, we start getting farming and agriculture. But again, it can change from place to place. And the Neolithic, well, a lot of people forget that something like the early ancient Egyptians were Stone Age. They were Neolithic. They, bronze came in not in the first dynasty, but a few dynasties into the story of the ancient Egyptians, so it gives you an idea of how long they've been around. Just one point on that. When Julius Caesar went to the pyramids to look at the pyramids, we are in closer to time to Julius Caesar than Julius Caesar is to the building of the pyramids. That's how old they are. So, I'm just throwing all this out. That's a lot of information, lots of different times, lots of different places there. But it does show you that, people think, oh, Stone Age, it's boring. It's just people sitting in caves or scratching their bottoms and eating raw meat. It is so much more than that.
It is, and there's such a big topic. Now, one of the things that you did mention there, which is a topic that we've discussed again and again, is you kept doing this wonderful thing, well, depends where. And we've discussed this before on the idea of actually using era names can be unhelpful. Using something like the Iron Age, the Bronze Age, because the Bronze Age is something that is entirely different depending where in the world you are. But I think certainly parts of the Stone Age, when we're dealing with large chunks of time, it is a useful tool, as it were, to be able to use to say the Stone Age. It does cover, to a certain extent, large amounts of the world at the same period of time. And as you say, especially when we're dating it back to slightly pre-human and things like that as well. What are your thoughts about actually using the term Stone Age and Paleolithic, Neolithic, Mesolithic within that? Do you think it's as bad as some of the confusion that it's caused when we say the Iron Age or not?
I think it's a necessary evil, particularly where you get to something like the Paleolithic, because We're certainly not in a historical setting at that point, but we're on the edges of what's the difference between archaeology and geology. You know, geologists are the ones that, an anthropologist and paleontologists are the ones who dig up dinosaurs. And really, you could argue that those people could also be digging up the very earliest hominid. That's the sort of ape-like humans or human-like apes, depending on which way you want to go with that. But, you know, they're clearly not quite chimpanzees, but they're not, certainly not Homo sapiens yet. And you get things, ridiculously complicated names to spell, like Australopithecus ramidus and other sorts of things. Homo heidelbergensis. Homo erectus is easier to spell, at least. But you then got Neanderthal, which are not ancestors of humans. They're cousins. They're an offshoot. They died out. We continued. So, you know, I find that area fascinating, because what all of history has in common is it's humans versus humans. But, you know, what was it like? The answer is we have no idea. We can only guess. But what was it like with a bunch of Homo sapiens living just down the river from a bunch of Neanderthals? You know, we do know from DNA studies that they did interbreed. Not all the time, but they were capable of interbreeding. The definition of a different species is an inability to mate with each other. So, for example, a dolphin can't breed with a Labrador or something like that. There's just too many genetic differences.
Hang on, I've just got to phone the lab, tell them to cancel the experiments.
Sorry about that. The dolphin Labrador hybrid, you're gonna have to put on hold. But Neanderthals could breed with human beings, Homo sapiens. But you know, there's the big question of, did they talk? You know, were Neanderthals able to construct language? And we know that some of the, you know, the humans are not the only things that have ever created tools. You know, Neanderthal tools, these are a different sort of genetic makeup to us. You know, I just find all of this fascinating, right down to the fact that I will always go to the British Museum. When you go to the British Museum, everyone goes to see the mummies or the Rosetta Stone, or, you know, there are sort of various key bits. I'll always go to the Stone Age area, and they've got some stuff from the Great Rift Valley in Kenya. And, you know, these are very rudimentary stone tools, but they're over a million years old. And, you know, just outstripping everything else in the British Museum, and everyone just walks past them. It's like, guys, what you're looking at there is the stealth bomber of the Paleolithic. You know, that was when suddenly we were enhancing ourselves through tools. And that's a huge deal when you think about it. One last thing, because I know I'm rambling on a bit here, is, of course, you said, you know, do you have a problem with these names? The one problem is Stone Age. Well, as soon as you start doing the archaeology around it, you'll realize that that's a really stupid thing to say. It's a bit like calling today the Plastic Age. It's because it's the only stuff that survives 2 million years. You know, the reality is there are some very rare finds of things like wooden finds and antler and sort of bits of leather and things like that. The reality is they used whatever was around them. It's just stone doesn't rot. That's why we think of them as only exclusively using wooden tools. But if you think about using something like bone, for example, that would be just as useful a stabbing device, or maybe sort of turning it into arrowheads. It's just it doesn't survive hundreds of thousands of years. Over to you, Greg.
Okay, well, I'm gonna bounce around those points and see what I can dig out of them. First things first is, when we're talking about the different ages around the world, one of the things that I only found out really probably a year and a half ago, but I found quite fascinating, is because one of the things I link with the Stone Age, one of the things that is just completely and utterly linked in my mind, is the idea of the woolly mammoth. If I go into schools and I'm doing a presentation about the Stone Age and I say, okay, what sort of animal, you know, I say, right, we're gonna send this person out hunting, he's a hunter-gatherer, what's he going to hunt? The answer comes back is the woolly mammoth. And so you think of this woolly mammoth as being this thing that's way off in the past, way off in the distance. And, well, yeah, okay, we're separated from the mammoth now. But there is this temptation to take the mammoths way back, you know, sort of 50,000 years, if you think about when the mammoths died out. And the fact of the matter is, just to give an idea of the differences around the world in the way times are, you mentioned there Julius Caesar and the pyramids. Well, the fact of the matter is the pyramids, the Great Pyramids, were actually built while there were still mammoths on Earth. The last mammoths living on the Wrangel Islands only died out about 1600 years BC. So actually, we had mammoths contemporary in a different part of the world, but we did have woolly mammoths contemporary with the pyramids. And it's one of those things, once we start dividing history into eras, and we have the Stone Age, and like I say, my mind, Stone Age mammoths, and then we talk about the Egyptians, in my mind, those are separated by a long period of time, and yet what they're actually separated by is distance around the globe, and not necessarily purely by time. So that was just a minor little point about the woolly mammoths, but it does lead me on to another point about the woolly mammoths. And, Jim, I have sort of collections of strange and exotic things around my house. As you know, Felicity is...
Felicity's not one of the strange things. Don't mention her in the same sentence.
I don't know. I think she'd disagree with you. But anyway, she's a fossil hunter, and we have various fossils. I do fossil walks and things, and it's one of the interesting things is what you mentioned there, which was DNA. You mentioned the DNA. We can study the DNA of Neanderthals. And the important thing is that although it sounds a long time ago, if we're talking about things that were around 50,000 years ago, 100,000 years ago, it sounds a long time ago, it's actually quite crucial that it's not millions of years ago. And it's easy to see in our heads that there's not much difference between, you know, 100,000 years, a million years ago. Both of them really, you know, they're just a long, long time ago. But the crucial difference is, and I'm going to describe this crucial difference, I'm afraid, Jem, by going slightly base, going lowest common denominator and all of that. I want to talk to you today, Jem, about poo, if I may, just briefly.
You can talk about coprolites all you want.
Okay, well, I actually want to talk about coprolite and I want to talk about poo. This is a distinction I want to make, but a pat on the back for you for knowing the word coprolite.
Because that is pat now, a reference to more poo, of course.
Well, I do actually have downstairs, not in the kitchen, luckily, but I do actually have downstairs two historical pieces of poo. One of them, as referenced, is a piece of coprolite. And coprolite, for those people who don't know, is dinosaur droppings. It's what the dinosaurs left behind. It's at least 65 million years old. And the important thing about that is it has fossilized. Now, fossilization, of course, is the process of things turning to stone. And that's a piece that I'll get out when I'm doing my school talks. It's part of our props kit for that. And we're doing a school talk. By the way, quick plug, Island Gems Fossil Shop on the Isle of Wight. Check it out. It's them I do the fossil talks with. So as I'm talking about their stuff, I ought to mention them. And I'll get to this point in the talk, and we will have a child hold this coprolite. And they think they're holding a rock until eventually it is revealed that they're holding a piece of dinosaur poo. But the fact of the matter is, it's completely fossilized. It's just a rock. It's exactly the same as any other rock you'll find, except for its origins. On the flip side, we also have downstairs a nice lump of baby mammoth poo as well, which is probably about 50,000 years old and crucially has not fossilized. You can still see the fibers in it. It does have a bad habit of shedding bits and pieces everywhere. It's not soft and squishy, luckily. It's fairly solid now, but it hasn't fossilized. We also have a mammoth tusk as well. And when we bring that out, a lot of people expect, again, the mammoth tusk to have fossilized, expected to have turned to stone. It hasn't. It is still ivory. It's still exactly as it was. It is a piece of ivory. And I think this is the important distinction. When we're talking prehistory, there is an important distinction about whether we're going far enough back for something to be fossilized or not. Because the fact of the matter is, it's very, very rare to get anything from a dinosaur where there's any suggestion that there might be the possibility of getting any sort of DNA sample whatsoever. Most of what we find with dinosaurs that far back are stone. But when we're talking about the Stone Age, we do have quite a few examples of mammoths that have been found frozen. We have things like peat bog bodies that are found from the Stone Age, where we have humans who are well preserved. We also, as you point out, have DNA samples going right back to Neanderthals, which means we can do a lot more, and as time goes on and science goes on, we can do a lot more genetic breakdowns and a lot more studies of the genetics, to the extent that I believe you can, if you have quite a lot of money to spare for no apparent reason, I believe you can actually have a DNA test done on yourself to find out what percentage Neanderthal you are, to find out exactly how far back your ancestors crossed over with Neanderthals as well. So I find that a crucial dividing point. When we get to that point, I think it's about a million years things to fossilize, don't quote me on that, but we reach that dividing point where suddenly we're not dealing just with stone and fossils, but we are dealing with a world where we can actually look at DNA and we can actually see flesh and colours and things like that as well.
Yes, that's of course the physical evidence being left at the end there. But of course there's the big question about culture. And this is why I wanted to say it gets complicated as to when the Stone Age ended. Because when you look at things like the Aztecs, Mayans and Incas, although they had got to the point of forging soft, easy metals, but precious metals like silver and gold, their tools and the way they constructed everything was with stone tools. They were still very much in the Stone Age, and yet they had developed their own complex mathematics, their own writing, their own extremely complex agricultural systems and civilization and culture and legends. So if they could do it all independently of everybody else, you know, why does that mean that we were apparently scratching our bottoms, you know, 5,000 years ago in Europe? It's just because we have no evidence. And actually, it was, I'm trying to remember where it was. I saw this wonderful mock-up of this family in a sort of Stone Age setting. And basically, half of them were in exactly what you've got in your head, you know, with just sort of barely stitched together pelts of various animal furs, and they're all still very naturally of their color. And the other half of them, they were covered in things like woad, which was body paint, and they had sort of swirling patterns on their fabrics and things like that. And in other words, saying, look, we only show you bare bones animal pelts because that's the only stuff we found or the only stuff that survived. But humans are humans. They're always trying to look pretty and cool and things like that. And if you like, the British Museum, I don't think this is on display anymore, but the British Museum has an example of this. And I actually mentioned this in my very first book, The Busy Person's Guide to British History, which is somebody made many thousands of years ago a stone dagger. But the interesting thing was they did enough chipping away at the handle that it looked like it had a leather sheath around it and was stitched together. And you could therefore argue this is the world's first cheap knockoff, because clearly that's copying another thing that actually had a leather handle with some stitching on it. But that would never have survived thousands of years. And it's because of this stone duplicate of this other one that we know that that was definitely a thing back then in the Neolithic. But when you look at the complexities of early ancient Egyptian society and the Mayans and all these other ones, you realize the Stone Age was not necessarily the same thing as a lack of culture, that people sort of dragging their knuckles behind them. It gets more difficult when you go back into the Paleolithic and, you know, how far back, you know, clearly chimpanzees do not build structures, and they, you know, they do have language, but they don't have complex language and certainly no writing. So, you know, at what point did all this stuff start popping up? The answer is we don't know. But just one example of how things were completely rewritten about 20 years ago is we look at things like the pyramids, and you go back just a couple of centuries earlier than the pyramids and you get Stonehenge, and you go back about 500 years past that and there are various structures on the island of Malta. So people think that when it comes to structures, basically you go back about 5, maximum 6,000 years. And then in Turkey, modern-day Turkey, Anatolia, they found two sites. There was Göbekli Tepe and Çatalhöyük. Çatalhöyük is thousands of years, it's about 8,000 years old, and it's a small little town. And so you've actually got a sedimentary population clearly using agriculture, although the fields don't exist. This was a people who actually stayed there. And this is thousands of years earlier than we thought could ever be possible. And then they found Göbekli Tepe, which is, depending on which bit of it, it's between 10 and 12,000 years old. So to put that into context, Greg, you and I are closer to the building of Stonehenge than Stonehenge is from being built with Göbekli Tepe. And Göbekli Tepe is a temple. It's clearly not a place where people lived, but it's got carvings in stone. It makes Stonehenge look rubbish, quite frankly. And yet it is well into the Mesolithic era. Arguably at the edges of the Paleolithic era, depending on where you are. But clearly it shows a level of sophistication and culture and some kind of religion or ceremony going on here. And, you know, it absolutely blew everybody's mind. Now, that's not to say it was built by aliens or anything like that, but it's an absolute reminder that human beings have always thought the same way as modern human beings. And we always like to tend to gather together, and we tend to like to think about things bigger than us as well. We can call that religion or being part of a tribe or perhaps just gathering together to pray for a good hunt or something like that rather than a specific temple of worship. I don't know, because nobody knows, because nobody wrote anything down. But this is all far more complicated than what most people's initial thoughts are of, well, neither of us have actually used it, but cavemen. You know, caveman, that people did occasionally live in caves, and you do get the amazing cave paintings in France. But that wasn't the only way human beings lived prior to civilization, whatever that is.
And I think what we've done there is we're trying to try to sum up, again, a lot of history in a very, very short amount of time. And I am aware that we're moving towards the end of the episode. But you mentioned things like Stonehenge there, and Stonehenge is one of those things that brings up the problems of really trying to understand history, and especially trying to understand history if people are also going to try and add their own significance onto things, if they're going to look at things, and then we get legend mixed in with history. I know Stonehenge, for example, you have the big druid gathering there every year because it, you know, the idea of it being used as a religious place and druid festivals being held there go back for thousands of years and what have you. And
but no, they don't. No, this is where I'm going to. Yeah, oh, sorry. Yeah, you tell the story.
The first druid festival. This is my point. The first druid festival we have any record of whatsoever. The first druid at Stonehenge is 1905. That's the first involvement. But because the festivals happen now, and because they've tried to build this this idea that it goes back thousands of years, it begins to muddy the water a little bit. Did you have anything else on that before I slide on?
Just one point on that, because the druids are from the Celtic era, the Iron Age, which is thousands of years after when Stonehenge was built. And when the Romans tried to wipe out, well, they didn't try, they successfully wiped out the druids. Their sort of central territory, the place which they gathered to for their last great stand, was Anglesey in North Wales, which is a long way away from where Stonehenge is. They clearly, it was not that an important place for the Druids, if they even knew about it at the time. So the Druids and Stonehenge are completely unrelated to each other, but you're quite right. This is sort of like other people hijacking older things and trying to sort of tie themselves into it, which, you know, doesn't really work. Now, just one last thing from personal experience. Almost all of my digs when I was at university doing my degree in archaeology and medieval history were Stone Age. And my professor, he came up with a very valid point going, look, we only tend to dig where there's interesting stuff sticking out the ground, like at Stonehenge. Instead, we should look at what areas were likely to be and lived in, let's say 5,000 years ago, and dig at the places where that would be a convenient place to gather water or go hunting. And everywhere he dug, he found something. And there's a pit in Wiltshire. We basically found a huge production area of flint tools. There's microliths and microburans. Microliths are tiny little flakes of stone that you might stick 10 of them into the edge of a piece of wood, and then you've got something like a harpoon, to harpoon fish. So that's a microlith. And then to chip off that the little bits chipped off that are called microburans. If you can find a microburan, that tells you it has to have been made there, because that's not something that's carried anywhere. And we found loads of microliths and a few microburans. So we found a massive production of flint, which at that time would have made it. The thing is, though, he died a few years after that, so it was never published, and I think people are trying to go back to it, but it would have made it the most amount of flint production in the whole of Europe. Now, even if that's been beaten by somewhere else, the point is, this is a place that's literally just a farm nowadays, but because he looked at the ancient landscape, he went, that's probably a place people would be living. He found it. He absolutely found it. And he kept finding interesting stuff like that. Last thing I'll say on that is, anything that's been ritually deposited, anything that's been put in a place for a reason, is called a cult. And we managed to find ritually deposited 3 cow pelvises that seem to have been pegged down onto the ground. We have no idea why they did that. But yes, we found the cult of the cow pelvis.
Well, I am actually starting up the Cult of the Cow Pelvis. If people would like to send a large check to the Cult of the Cow Pelvis, then you will get, I don't know what, eternal milk
cow pelvises.
I've got no idea. Anyway,
I think you might need to call actually not the cult, but maybe that. You know what? That sounds like a heavy metal band name. So I think you need to start a heavy metal band called Cult of the Cow Pelvis.
Cult of the Cow Pelvis. I do like that. Yeah. Okay. Well, this is our heavy metal band. So I mean, obviously, there is no one better place to start a heavy metal band than me and Jem. I got one more thing I'm going to finish up with then. Leading into something entirely off topic, as it should. One of the local stone, because we've got quite a few Neolithic sites here on the Isle of Wight, and one of the local ones that I take students up to every year when we do a Paleolithic week, I take them up to see the Motterstone Longstone. And the Motterstone Longstone is a large standing stone with another stone lying next to it. And this is one of those examples of people making mistakes on first looking, because people looked at this and they assumed that this was how the monument was set up. And it was believed for a certain amount of time in the Victorian period that therefore this was a sacrificial stone. The large standing stone was religiously significant, and the one lying next to it was a table for human sacrifice. The fact of the matter, of course, being once they did a little bit more research, they realised that the two stones should have been standing next to each other and that they were actually the entrance to a burial site. And it's kind of this sort of way where you can see how if we don't have information and you're just looking at things as they've survived today, you can easily get confused. I mean, Let's go a weird way. Let's assume that your cow pelvises, maybe they weren't pegged to the ground. Maybe someone was playing some weird version of Hoopla with cow pelvises. I don't know how that would have worked. But anyway, we do make mistakes as historians, and the important thing is we try and correct them. So just to round off the topic before we go to the plugs, one little story that I heard over the winter months. I was leading one of the fossil walks on the beach, and I had a lovely gentleman from Belgium coming on the walk with me. And he was talking about one of the most famous species of dinosaur. I think most people have heard of it, is the Iguanodon. He's the one, you recognise him. He's got the great big spikes on his thumbs. And one of the most famous types of that is the Iguanodon bernicetensis, which is found in this town in Belgium. And this guy was telling me that he'd been to the museum and he'd seen the skeletons of the Iguanodon there. And he said the trouble is that they'd been built, they'd been put together, they'd assembled these skeletons, and then sort of more evidence had come out and they realised that the skeletons had actually been put together slightly wrong. And he said to me that he was very pleased because they dealt with the problem in a very, very Belgian way. And that was that rather than disassembling and reassembling the skeletons, they've put a sign underneath that basically says, look, we know these are wrong, but it's a lot of effort to change it.
Nice. I'm going to just say one last thing back to your thing about the summer solstice and the druids and Stonehenge. It always makes me cringe, and it just shows how little these people know about the site. Because remember this, people, the next time you get to the summer solstice and you see these idiots, sometimes with vans near the Stonehenge, and that's this.
I would just like to disassociate myself with the idiot comment from my colleague. Please address all angry emails.
Wait till I say it, because immediately around Stonehenge, all the way around it, there is a earthen ditch and ramp, basically a ridge. And it's older than Stonehenge. And that's where they found a couple of richly deposited bodies. So clearly that is also part of the ritual of Stonehenge. And that's what everybody's trampling over to get to the pretty stones, showing complete ignorance of the archaeology of the site. So I'm going to stand by my idiot's comment. And if you wish to challenge it, bring it on, is all I'm going to say. Right, should we get to plugs before I get too much hate crime against me?
Should we get to plugs? By the way, I will also point out that there is an awful lot of Stonehenge that's not actually at Stonehenge. Did you know, Jim, that before the 1900s, if you'd gone to visit Stonehenge, you could have hired a chisel so you could take your own piece off the henge to take home with you?
Doesn't surprise me at all, no.
Okay, what have you got to plug this week?
Well, I'm going to do my other podcast, be it briefly, just saying, look, if you like my voice and you like pop culture, I do a slightly different take on history by combining the two. So I start with something like, let's say, a video game, and then say, oh, but this is set in a certain time, and then talk about the real history behind the video game, or a movie, or a TV show, or a comic book even. So if you like the sound of that, it's called Neon. That's just what it's called, Neon. You can sort of find out more about it on Neon Podcast on Twitter, or neonpodcast.com, that's the website, or you could just go on to whatever app you get podcasts and just type in Neon and you'll find Neon. It's the black one with the blue writing, really very easy to find. If you like it, do, as always, as Greg says, leave a review. That always helps spread the word.
And for my plug, I would like to plug Trampling Stonehenge, which is the first album from the heavy metal band Cult of the Cow Pelvises.
I'd buy that.
It's available in all good record shops, probably never. I'd also like to give a little plug for my podcast, Greg Chapman's Tales from the Road. Again, you'll find it everywhere. But as Jem says, whether it's this podcast, whether it's Jem's podcast, whether it's my podcast, whether it's your favourite book that you've just read on Amazon, it really helps anyone trying to create anything if you just take a time on the internet to click on the ratings button and take 30 seconds just to leave a little review underneath. Even if your review just says, I enjoyed this podcast, that boosts it up the rankings and really does help out. Because me and Jem, we don't get paid for these podcasts. We do them because we enjoy doing them, and we just want more people to hear them. Most importantly, therefore, thank you very much to every one of you who is currently listening to this podcast. And thank you to everyone who shares it around, spreads around, lets other people know it exists. And, of course, a massive thank you to my wonderful co-host, Mr. Jem Deducci.
And to my heavy metal king and god co-host, Greg Chapman.
And that's all for us this week. We will be back next Tuesday, provided that our heavy metal career hasn't taken us away from this in the meantime. And don't forget that on Friday, you will have another Fast Five as well. But for now, thank you all so much for listening. Oh, actually, just before I finish up, Jem, I just wanted to bring this up on the podcast, and I know we're going to seriously overrun time now, but I was listening to your Fast Five recently, your Fast Five about historical word crimes.
Yes.
I can't help noticing how that particular Fast Five ended.
I can't remember either.
My fiance sat there, she listened to it, and she said, did Jem just use your catchphrase?
Ah, okay, fair enough. Well, I'm allowed to. We're on the same podcast. I can do whatever I want. As long as I don't accidentally marry your fiance, I think we're okay with that.
I think we're okay. Well, thank you very much, everyone, for listening. So, from both me and Jim, goodbye and take care.